These fossils were the remains of the largest creatures that ever walked on the face of the earth. Creatures unsuspected by science, unknown to mankind, until their little party had dug them up in the middle of the Montana Badlands. "With all my heart," he wrote in his journal, "I wish to leave these accursed rocks right here in this accursed town, right here in this accursed wilderness. With all my heart, I wish to leave them and go home to Philadelphia and never think again in my life of cope or marsh or rock strata or dinosaur genera or any other of this exhausting and tedious business. And to my horror, I find I cannot. I must take them back with me, or stay with them as a mother hen stays with her eggs. Damn all principles." While Johnson was examining the fossils, Perkins pointed to a jumble of material under a tarp. "This yours, too? What's all this?" "That's photographic equipment," Johnson said absently. "Know how to use it?" "Sure." "Well then, your troubles are over." "How's that?" "We had a man who made photographic pictures. He took his camera out on the road south of town last spring. Just him and his horse, to take photos of the land. Why, I do not know. Ain't nothing there. The next stagecoach found him on his back, with the turkey vultures on him. That camera was in 1,000 pieces. "What happened to all his plates and chemicals?" "We still got them, but nobody knows what to do with them." The Black Hills Art Gallery. "How quickly can one's disadvantages be turned to profit," Johnson wrote in his journal. "With the opening of my studio, the Black Hills Art Gallery, my every character flaw is perceived in a new light. Before, my Eastern habits were seen as lacking masculinity. Now they are proof of artistry. Before, my disinterest in mining was viewed with suspicion. Now, with relief. Before, I had nothing that anyone wanted. Now, I can provide what everyone will pay dearly to possess. A portrait." Johnson rented a location in the south bend of Deadwood, because the light was stronger there for more of the day. The Black Hills Art Gallery was located behind Kim Sing's laundry, and business was brisk. Johnson charged $2 for a portrait, and later, as demand increased, raised his price to $3. He could never get used to the demand. In this rude and bleak setting, hard men want nothing more than to sit as like death and walk away with their likeness. The life of a miner was back-breaking and exhausting. All these men had come a long and dangerous way to seek their fortune in the rugged wilderness, and it was clear that few would succeed. Photographs provided a tangible reality to men who were far from home, fearful and tired. They were posed proofs of success, souvenirs to send to sweethearts and loved ones, or simply ways of remembering, of grasping a moment in a swiftly changing and uncertain world. His business was not limited to portraits. When the weather was bright, he made excursions to placer mines outside town, to photograph men working at their claims. For this, he charged $10. Meanwhile, most of the businesses in town hired him to portray their establishments. There were moments of minor triumph. On September 4th, he tersely records, "Photograph of Colonel Ramsey Stablery. Charged $25 because of large plate required." He hated to pay. F11 at 22 seconds. Dull day. And he was apparently pleased to become a full citizen of the town. As the days passed, Foggy Johnson, a contraction of photographer, became a familiar figure in Deadwood, known to everyone. He also acquired the frustrations of commercial photographers everywhere. On September 9th, Broken Nose Jack McCall, a notorious gunman, returned to complain of his portrait made yesterday. He showed it to his inamorata, Sarah, who said it did not flatter him, so he was back to demand a more sympathetic version. "Mr. McCall has a face like a hatchet, a sneer that would kill a cow from fright, a pox-scarred complexion, and a walleye. I told him politely that I had done the best I could, considering. He discharged his pistols in the art gallery, until I offered to try again at no charge. He sat once more, and he wanted a different pose, with his chin resting on his hand. But the effect of his pose was to portray him as a pensive, effeminate scholar. It was wholly unsuited to his station in life, but he would hear no disagreement about the pose. Upon my retiring to the darkroom, Broken Nose waited outside, allowing me to hear the clicking of his pistol chambers as he reloaded his revolver, in anticipation of my latest effort. Such is the nature of art critics in Deadwood, and under such circumstances, my work surpassed my own expectations. Although I lost a deal of sweat before Broken Nose and Sarah pronounced themselves satisfied. Apparently, Johnson knew the rudiments of retouching photographs. By the judicious use of pencils, it was possible to soften signs of scarring and to make other adjustments. Not everyone wanted his picture taken. On September 12th, Johnson was hired to photograph the interior of the Deadwood Melodeon Saloon, a drinking and gambling establishment at the south end of the main street. Interiors were dark, and he often had to wait several days for strong light to carry out a commission. But a few days later the weather was sunny, and he arrived at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with his equipment, and set up to make an exposure. The Melodeon Saloon was a dingy place, with a long bar on the back wall and 3 or 4 rough tables for playing cards. Johnson went around throwing back the curtains on the windows, flooding it with light. The patrons groaned and cursed. The proprietor, Leander Samuels, cried out, "Now, gents, be easy." Johnson ducked under the cloth of his camera to compose the shot, and a voice said, "What the hell you doing, Foggy?" "Taking a picture," Johnson said. "Like hell." Johnson looked up. Black Dick, the miner's friend, had risen from one of the card tables. His hand rested on his gun. "Now, Dick," said Mr. Samuels, "it's just a picture." "It's disturbing my peace." "Now, Dick," Mr. Samuels began.
"I've said my say," Dick threatened. "I'm playing cards now, and I don't want no picture."
"Perhaps you'd like to step outside while the picture is made," Johnson said.
"Perhaps you'd like to step outside with me," Dick said.
"No, thank you, sir," Johnson said.
"Then you just take yourself and your contraption out, and don't come back. Now, Dick, I hired Foggy. I want a picture for the wall behind the bar. I think it'd look fine."
"That's all right," Dick said. "He can come back any time he likes, long as I'm not here. No one takes my likeness." He poked a finger at Johnson, showing off the snake tattoo on his wrist, which he was vain about.
"Now you remember that, and you get out."
Johnson got out.
That was the first sure indication that Black Dick was a wanted man somewhere or other. Nobody in Deadwood was surprised to hear it, and the mystery it added to Dick only increased his reputation. But it was also the beginning of trouble between Johnson and the three Curry brothers, Dick, Clem, and Bill, that would later cause him so much misery. But while his business prospered, he didn't have much time to amass his profits. On September 13th, he wrote, "I am generally informed that the mountain roads close with snow by Thanksgiving latest, and perhaps by November 1st. I must be ready to make my departure before the end of October, or remain until the following spring. Each day I record my accounts and my costs. For the life of me, I do not see how I can possibly make enough money in time to leave." His journal for the next few days was filled with despairing comments, but 2 days after that, Johnson's fortunes again underwent a dazzling change. "My prayers are answered," he wrote. "The army has come to town." The army arrives. On September 14th, 1876, 2,000 miners lined the streets of Deadwood, firing pistols into the air and shouting their welcome as General George Crook and his column of the 2nd Cavalry rode through the town. "It would be hard to imagine a more popular sight to the locals," wrote Johnson, "for everyone here fears Indians, and General Crook has waged a successful war against them since spring." The arriving army presented a notably rugged appearance after their months on the plains. When General Crook signed into the Grand Central Hotel, Perkins, in his polite way, suggested that the general might wish to visit the Deadwood Baths, and perhaps also to obtain a set of new clothing from a dry goods store. General Crook took the hint, and was cleaned up when he stepped onto the Grand Central balcony and made a brief speech to the throng of miners below. Johnson viewed the festivities, which ran long into the night, with an entirely different perspective. "Here, at last," he wrote, "is my ticket to civilization." Johnson asked Crook's quartermaster, Lieutenant Clark, about joining the cavalry for the march south. Clark said that would be fine, but he would have to square it with the general himself. Wondering how to meet the man, Johnson thought perhaps he should offer to take his picture. "General hates pictures," Clark advised him. "Don't do it. Go up directly and just ask him." "Very well," Johnson said. "One other thing," Clark said. "Don't shake hands. General hates to shake hands." "Very well," Johnson said. Major General George Crook was every inch a military man. Short cropped hair, piercing eyes, a full flowing beard, and ramrod erect posture as he sat in his chair in the dining room. Johnson waited until the man had finished his coffee and some of his admirers had departed for the gambling halls before he approached and explained his situation. Crook listened patiently to Johnson's tale, but before long he was shaking his head, murmuring that he could not take civilians on a military expedition with all the hazards involved. He was sorry, but it was impossible. Then Johnson mentioned the fossil bones he wished to take home. "Fossil bones?" "Yes, General." Crook said, "You have been digging fossil bones?" "Yes, General."
"And you are from Yale?"
"Yes, General." His whole manner changed.
"Then you must be associated with Professor Marsh of Yale," he said.
After the briefest hesitation, Johnson said that he was indeed associated with Professor Marsh.
"Marvelous man. Charming, intelligent man," Crook said. "I met him in Wyoming in 72. We went hunting together. Outstanding man. Remarkable man."
"None quite like him," Johnson agreed.
"You're with his party?"
"I was. I became separated from it."
"Damned bad luck," Crook said. "Well, anything I can do for Marsh, I will. You are welcome to join my column, and we will see your fossil bones safely to Cheyenne."
"Thank you, General."
"Have your bones loaded on a suitable wagon. Quartermaster Clark will assist you in any way you need. We march at dawn day after tomorrow. Happy to have you with us."
"Thank you, General."
Last day in Deadwood. On September 15th, his last full day in Deadwood, Johnson undertook two final photo assignments. In the morning he rode out to Negro Gulch to photograph the colored miners who had made a fabulous strike there. 6 miners had been taking out nearly $2,000 a day for weeks. Their ore was shipped home, and they had already sold their claim. Now they were posing, putting on their old work clothes and standing by the flume for the photograph, then dressing again in their new duds and burning the old clothes. They were in high spirits and wanted the picture to take to St. Louis. For his part, Johnson was pleased to see miners so well disciplined that they were taking their findings home with them. Most left their earnings in the saloons or on the green felt of the gaming tables. But these men were different. "They are ever so cheerful," Johnson wrote, no doubt cheerful himself,
and I wish them the best of luck in their journey home. In the afternoon, he photographed the facade of the Grand Central Hotel for its owner, Sam Perkins.
You photographed everyone else, Perkins said, and since you're leaving town, it's the least you can do.
Johnson was obliged to set up his camera across the street. Had he set up closer, the passing horses and carriages would have kicked mud in the lens. The intervening street traffic would appear to obstruct the view of the hotel. But Johnson knew that moving objects, horses and wagons, would not leave more than a ghostly streak in a time exposure. For all intents and purposes, the hotel would appear to stand on an empty street. Indeed, it was a problem when photographers tried to represent the busy street activity of towns, because the movement of horses and pedestrians and wagons was too quick for the film to record. Johnson made his usual exposure, F11 and 22 seconds, and then, since the light was especially strong and he had a spare plate that was wet and waiting, he decided to try to capture the street life of Deadwood in a final quick shot. He exposed the last plate at F3.5 and 2 seconds. Johnson developed both plates in his dark room at the Black Hills Art Gallery, and while they were drying, purchased a suitable wagon to transport his bones with the cavalry. Then he went to the hotel to load the fossils and have his final dinner in Deadwood. He arrived just in time to see a body carried out into the street. Norman H. Texas Tom Walsh had been found strangled in his room on the second floor of the Grand Central Hotel. Texas Tom was a short, feisty man who was rumored to be a member of the Curry Gang of stage robbers. Suspicion of murder naturally fell on Black Dick Curry, also staying in the hotel at the time. But no one was brave enough to make an accusation. For his part, Black Dick claimed to have spent all afternoon in the Melodeon Saloon, and to be innocent of any knowledge of what might have happened to Texas Tom. And there the matter might have ended, had not Sam Perkins decided to stop by Johnson's table and ask, during dinner, about the hotel portrait.
"Did you make it today?" Perkins asked.
"I did."
"And how did it turn out?"
"Very nicely," Johnson said. "I will have a print for you tomorrow."
"What time do you take it?" Perkins asked.
"Must have been about 3 o'clock in the afternoon."
"Aren't there shadows then? I'd hate the place to look all depressing with shadows."
"There were some shadows," Johnson said, but he explained that shadows made a picture look better, giving it more depth and character. It was then that Johnson noticed that Black Dick was listening to their conversation with interest.
"Where'd you take the picture from?" Perkins asked.
"Across the street."
"Where? Over by Donahue's store?"
"No, farther south, by Kim Singh's."
"What are you fellers yammering on about?" Black Dick asked. "Foggy took a portrait picture of the hotel today."
"Did he?" The voice went cold.
"When was that?"
Johnson instantly felt danger in the situation, but Perkins was oblivious to it.
"What did you just say, Foggy? About 3 o'clock?
"Something about there," Johnson said.
Dick cocked his head. He fixed Johnson with a watchful eye.
"Foggy, I warned you once about photographing when I was around."
"But you weren't around, Dick," Perkins said. "Remember, you told Judge Harlan that you were at the saloon all afternoon."
"I know what I told Judge Harlan," Dick growled. He turned slowly to Johnson. "Where'd you take the picture from, Foggy?"
"Across the street."
"Turn out good?"
"No. As a matter of fact, it didn't turn out at all. I'm going to have to take it again tomorrow."
He kicked Perkins under the table as he said it.
"I thought your pictures always turned out."
"Not always."
"Where's the picture you did today?"
"I scrubbed the glass plate. It wasn't any good."
Dick nodded.
"All right, then." And he turned back to his meal.
"You thinking what I'm thinking?"
Perkins asked later.
Yep, Johnson said.
Texas Tom had a room right at the front of the hotel, facing out on the street. Middle of the afternoon, sunlight would shine right in. Did you look real close at your picture?
No, Johnson said. I didn't.
At that moment, Judge Harlan came in puffing. They quickly told him the conversation with Black Dick.
I can't see as there's any case against Dick at all, he said. I've just come from the Melodeon. Everybody swears Dick Curry was playing Faro there all afternoon, just like he says.
Well, he must have paid them off.
There's 20 or more seen him.
I doubt he paid them all, Judge Harlan said.
No. Dick was there, all right.
Then who killed Texas Tom?
I'll worry over it at the inquest in the morning, Judge Harlan said.
Johnson intended to pack after dinner, but curiosity and Perkins's urging led him to the Black Hills Art Gallery instead.
Where are they?
Perkins asked when they had locked the door behind them. They inspected the two exposed plates. The first exposure was as Johnson had remembered, a deserted hotel with no people visible at all. The second plate showed horses in the streets and people walking through the mud.
Can you see the window? Perkins asked.
Not really, Johnson said, squinting, holding the plate to a kerosene lantern.
I can't see.
I think there's something there, Perkins said.
You have a glass? Johnson held a magnifying glass to the plate. Clearly visible in the second floor window were two figures. One was being strangled by a second man, who stood behind him.
I'll be damned, Perkins said.
You took a picture of the murder.
Can't see much, though, Johnson said.
Make it bigger, Perkins said.
I have to pack, Johnson said. I'm leaving with the cavalry at dawn.
Cavalry's drunk in the saloons all over town, Perkins said, and they'll never leave at dawn. Make it bigger.
Johnson had no enlarging equipment, but he managed to rig an impromptu outfit and exposed a print. They both peered into the developing tray as the image slowly appeared. In the window, Texas Tom struggled, his back arched with effort, his face contorted. Two hands gripped his neck. But the killer's body was blocked by the curtain to the left, and the killer's head was in deep shadow.
Better, Perkins said, but we still can't see who it is.
They made another print, and then another still larger. The work became slower as the evening progressed. The rigged system was sensitive to vibration at great magnification, and Perkins was so excited he could not stand still during the long exposure. Shortly before midnight, they got a clear one. At great magnification, the picture was speckled and grainy. But one detail came through. There was a tattoo on the left wrist of the strangling arm. It showed a curled snake.
We got to tell Judge Harlan, Perkins insisted.
I got to pack, Johnson said, and I got to get some sleep before I leave tomorrow.
But this is murder.
This is Deadwood, Johnson said. Happens all the time.
You're just going to leave?
I am.
Then give me the plate, and I'll go tell Judge Harlan.
Suit yourself, Johnson said, and gave him the plate. Back in the Grand Central Hotel lobby, he passed Black Dick Curry himself. Dick was drunk.
Howdy, Foggy, Dick said.
Howdy, Dick. Johnson said, and he went up to his room. It was, he observed in his journal, a fine, ironic last touch to his last day in notorious Deadwood. He had been packing for half an hour when Perkins showed up in his room with Judge Harlan.
You take this picture, Judge Harlan said.
I did, Judge.
You doctor this picture in any way, pencil touch-ups or whatever.
No, Judge.
That's fine, Judge Harlan said. We got him dead to rights.
I'm glad for you, Johnson said.
Inquest will settle it in the morning, Judge Harlan said.
Be there at 10 o'clock, Foggy.
Johnson said he was leaving town with General Crook's cavalry.
I'm afraid you can't, Judge Harlan said.
In fact, you're at some risk right here tonight. We're gonna have to take you into protective custody.
What are you talking about? Johnson asked.
I'm talking about jail, Judge Harlan said.
The next day in Deadwood.
Jail was an abandoned mine shaft at the edge of town. It was fitted with iron bars and a solid lock. After spending a night in the freezing cold, Johnson was able to look through the bars and watch the cavalry under the command of General George Crook ride south out of Deadwood. He shouted to them, shouted until he was hoarse, but no one paid any attention. No one came to let him out of jail until nearly noon, when Judge Harlan showed up, groaning and shaking his head.
What's the trouble? Johnson said.
A bit much to drink last night, the judge said.
He held the door wide.
You're free to go.
What about the inquest?
Inquest's been canceled.
What?
Judge Harlan nodded.
Black Dick Curry hightailed it out of town. Seems he got word of what was coming, and chose the better part of valor, as Shakespeare would say. An inquest's beside the point with Dick gone. You're free to go.
But the cavalry's a half day ahead of me now, Johnson said. I can never catch up with them.
True, the judge said. I'm real sorry for the inconvenience, son. I guess you'll be staying with us in Deadwood a while longer after all.
The story of Johnson's incriminating photograph, and how he had come to miss leaving with the cavalry, went through the town. It had serious consequences. The first was to worsen relations between Johnson and Black Dick Curry, the miner's friend. All the Curry brothers now were openly hostile to him, especially as Judge Harlan seemed uninterested in setting another inquest into the death of Texas Tom. When they were in town, which was whenever there was no stage leaving Deadwood for a day or so, they stayed at the Grand Central Hotel, and when they ate, which was seldom, they took their meals there. Johnson irritated Dick, who announced that Johnson behaved superior to everybody else with what he called his Philadelphia ways.
Pass the butter, would you please? Ha! Can't bear his farriery ways.
As the days passed, Dick took to bullying Johnson, to the amusement of his brothers. Johnson bore it quietly. There was nothing he could do, since Dick was only too ready to take an argument out into the street and settle it with pistols. He was a steady shot, even when drunk, and killed a man every few days. No one in town who knew Dick would go up against him, and certainly Johnson did not intend to. But it got so bad that he would leave the dining room before finishing his meal if Dick entered. And then there was the business of Miss Emily. Emily. Women in Deadwood were few, and no better than they needed to be. Most of them lived in a house called The Cricket, down at the end of the South Bend, where they plied their trade under the cold, watchful eye of Mrs. Marshall, who smoked opium and owned the house. Others were independent, like Calamity Jane, who in recent weeks had made a great show of mourning the death of Bill Hickok, much to the disgust of Hickok's friends. Calamity Jane was so masculine she often wore a soldier's uniform and traveled undetected with the boys in blue, giving them service in the field. She had gone with Custer's 7th Cavalry on more than one occasion. But she was so male that she often boasted that, "Give me a dildo in the dark and no woman can tell me from a true man." As one observer noted, this left Jane's appeal somewhat obscure. A few Deadwood miners had brought their wives and families, but they did not often show in town. Colonel Ramsey had a fat squaw wife named Senelise.
Mr. Samuels had a wife, too, but she was consumptive and always stayed indoors. So for the most part, the feminine element was provided by the cricket women and the girls who worked in the saloons. In the words of one Deadwood visitor, they were pleasant women of a certain age, but in appearance as hard and mean as the rest of the landscape of that wretched mining town. The ones that ran tables in the saloons smoked and swore with the best of the men, and were so full of tricks that seasoned gamblers avoided them, and preferred men as dealers. Into this hard-bitten world, Miss Emily Charlotte Williams appeared as a floating vision of loveliness. She arrived one noon on a miner's buckboard, dressed entirely in white, her blonde hair tied back fetchingly. She was young, though perhaps a few years older than Johnson. She was immaculate. She was delicate and fresh and sweet, and possessed some notable curvatures. When she took a room at the Grand Central Hotel, she became the most interesting new arrival since young Foggy had showed up with a wagonload of mysterious crates and two dead men covered in snow. News of Miss Emily, her lovely appearance, and her tender story raced around the town. Perkins's dining room, never before full, was packed that night as everyone came to get a look at the creature. She was an orphan, the daughter of a preacher, the Reverend Williams, who had been killed in the nearby town of Gayville while building a church. At first it was said that he had been shot by a devilish desperado, but it later turned out he had fallen from the roof under construction and broken his neck. In her grief, it was also said, Miss Emily had collected her few belongings and set out to find her brother Tom Williams, whom she knew to be prospecting somewhere in the Black Hills. She had already been to Montana City and Crook City, and had not succeeded in finding him. Now she was in Deadwood, where she planned to stay 3 or 4 days, perhaps more. The men in the Grand Central Hotel that night had bathed and were wearing the cleanest clothes they owned. Johnson recorded in his journal that it was amusing to see these hard men preen and puff up their chests while they tried to eat their soup without slurping. But there was a good deal of tension in the room as well, which was increased when Black Dick went over to Miss Emily's table. The object of all eyes was dining alone, and introduced himself. He offered to escort her around the town that evening. With admirable poise, she thanked him, but said she would be retiring early. He offered to assist her in finding her brother. She thanked him, but said that she had already had many offers of assistance. Dick was being watched by all the others, and knew it. He sweated. His face turned red, and he glowered.
"Seems I can't be of help to you, then. Is that it?"
"I appreciate your courteous offer. I surely do," she said softly. Dick appeared somewhat mollified as he stomped back to his table and huddled, commiserating with his brothers. And there the matter might have rested, had not Miss Emily turned to Johnson and said in her sweetest voice, "Oh, are you the young photographer I have heard so much about?" Johnson said he was.
"I should appreciate seeing your gallery of pictures," she said. "Perhaps my brother is among them."
"I will be happy to show them to you in the morning," Johnson answered, and she responded with a graceful smile. Black Dick looked fit to kill, Johnson in particular. "There is no greater pleasure than to win what everyone desires," Johnson noted in his pages. He went to bed a happy man. He had become accustomed to sleeping in the room next to the stacked crates. Accustomed not only to the fine powder that fell from them and dusted the floor, but also to the tomb-like darkness of the room itself, and a strange sense of intimacy to be sleeping with the bones of the great creatures themselves. And, of course, the immense teeth, the teeth of actual dragons that once walked the earth. He found their presence oddly comforting. And tomorrow would bring his appointment with Emily. But his happiness was short-lived. Emily was disappointed by his pictures, not finding her dear brother among them. "Perhaps you could look again," he suggested. She had gone through them very quickly. "No, no. I know he is not to be found in these." She prowled his shop restlessly, looking around. "Have you shown me all you have?" "All I have taken in Deadwood, yes." She pointed to a corner shelf. "You haven't shown me those." "Those are from my time in the Badlands. Your brother is not among those plates, I assure you."
"But I am interested to see. Bring them here, and come sit beside me, and tell me about the Badlands."
She was so charming, he could not possibly refuse her. He brought down the plates and showed her his pictures, which seemed now to belong to another lifetime.
"Who is this man with the tiny pick?"
"That's Professor Cope, with his geological hammer."
"And that beside him?"
"That's a skull of a saber-toothed tiger."
"And this man?"
"That's Cookie, our teamster and cook."
"And this? Is he standing with an Indian?"
"That's Charlie Sternberg and Little Wind. He was a snake scout. He died."
"Oh, dear. And this is the Badlands? It looks like the desert."
"Yes, you can see how eroded it is."
"How long did you spend there?"
6 weeks.
"And why would you go to such a place?"
"Well, where there is erosion, the bones stick out and are easier to uncover."
"You went there for bones?"
"Yes, of course."
"How very odd," she said. "Did bones pay you a lot?"
"No, I paid my own way."
"You paid your own way?"
She pointed to the desolate picture.
"To go there?"
"It's a long story," he said. "You see, I made a bet at Yale, and then I had to go." But he could tell she was not listening anymore. She thumbed through the glass plates, holding each to the light, glancing quickly, going on to the next. "What do you hope to find?" he asked, watching her.
"It is also strange to me," she said. "I was merely curious about you. Here, put them back."
As he replaced them on the shelf, she said,
"And did you find bones?"
"Oh yes, lots of them."
"Where are they now?"
"Half were taken down the Missouri River by steamer. I have the other half."
"You have them? Where?"
"In the hotel."
"Can I see these bones?" Something about her manner made him suspicious.
"Why would you want to do that?"
"I am just curious to see them, now that you have mentioned them.
Everyone in the town is curious to see them."
"Of course, if it is too much trouble..."
"Oh no," Johnson said. "It's no trouble." In his room, he opened one crate for her to see. Some gritty dirt fell to the floor.
"That's just old rocks," she said, peering at the pieces of black shale.
"No, no, this is a fossil."
"Look here," he said, and he traced the shape of a dinosaur leg. It was a perfect specimen. "But I thought you had found old bones, not rock."
"Fossil bones are rock."
"There's no need to snip."
"I'm sorry, Emily. But you see, these things have no value at all in Deadwood. They are bones which have lain in the earth for millions of years and which belonged to creatures long gone. This bone is from the leg of an animal with a horn on its nose, like a rhinoceros, but much larger."
"Really?"
"Yes."
"That seems wonderful, Bill," she said,
having decided to call him by that name. Her gentle enthusiasm touched him. She was the first sympathetic person he had come across in a long time.
"I know," he said, "but no one believes me.
The more I explain them, the more they disbelieve. And eventually they will break in and smash them all, if I don't get out of Deadwood first."
and despite himself, tears rolled down one cheek, and he turned away so that she would not see him cry. "Why, Bill, what's the matter?" she said, sitting down close to him on the bed. "It's nothing," he said, wiping his face and turning back. "It is just that I never asked for this job. I just came west, and now I am stuck with these bones, and they are my responsibility. And I want to keep them safe so the professor can study them. And people never believe me." "I believe you," she said. "Then you were the only one in Deadwood who does." "Shall I tell you a secret of my own?" she said. "I am not really an orphan." He paused, waiting. "I am from Whitewood, where I have lived since the summer." He still said nothing. She bit her lip. "Dick put me up to it." "Put you up to what?" he asked, wondering how she knew Dick. "He thought you would confide in a lady and tell me what the crates really contained." "So you said you would ask me," he said, feeling hurt. She looked down, as if ashamed. "I was curious myself, too. They really contain bones. I see that now. I don't want them. I don't want anything to do with them. But they are my responsibility." "I believe you," she frowned. "Now I must convince Dick. He is a hard man, you know." "I know. But I will talk to him," she said. "I will see you at dinner." That night in the Grand Central dining room, there were two new visitors. At first glance, they seemed to be twins, so similar was their appearance. They were both tall, lean, wiry men in their 20s, with identical broad mustaches and identical clean white shirts. They were quiet, self-contained men who emanated a forceful calmness. "Know who those two are?" Perkins whispered to Johnson over coffee. "No." "That's Wyatt Earp and his brother Morgan Earp. Wyatt's taller." At the mention of their names, the two men looked over at Johnson's table and nodded politely. "This here's Foggy Johnson. He's a photographer from Yale College," Perkins said. "Howdy," the Earp brothers said, and went back to their dinner. Johnson didn't recognize the names, but Perkins's manner suggested that they were important and famous men. Johnson whispered, "Who are they?" "They're from Kansas," Perkins said. "Abilene and Dodge City?" Johnson shook his head. "They're famous gunfighters," Perkins whispered. "Both of them." Johnson still had no notion of their importance, but any new visitor to Deadwood was fair game for a photograph, and after dinner he suggested it. In his journal, Johnson recorded his first conversation with the famous Earp brothers. It was not exactly a dramatic high point. "How would you gents like a photograph?" Johnson asked. "A photograph?" "Could be," Wyatt Earp said. Seen close, he was boyish and slender. He had a steady manner, a steady gaze, an almost sleepy calmness. "What'll it cost?" $4, Johnson said. The Earp brothers exchanged a silent glance. "No thanks," Wyatt Earp said. Emily's News. "It's no good," she whispered to him outside on the porch of the hotel before dinner. "The Curry boys are rattled by the Earp brothers arriving. It makes them jumpy. So they're coming for your bones tonight. They boasted about it." "They're not going to get them," Johnson said. "I believe they're in the habit of getting whatever they want." "Not this time." "What are you going to do?" "I'll stand guard over them," Johnson said, reaching for his gun.
"I wouldn't."
"What do you think I should do?"
"Best thing is step aside. Let them have them."
"I can't do that, Emily."
"They're hard men."
"I know that. But I must guard the bones."
"They're just bones."
"No. They're not. He saw her eyes light up.
They're valuable, then?
They're priceless. I told you.
Tell me really.
What are they really?
Emily,
they really are bones. Like I told you.
She looked disgusted.
If it was me, I wouldn't risk my life for a bunch of old bones.
It's not you.
And these bones are important. They are historical bones and important to science.
The Curry boys don't care a hoot for science,
and they'd be happy to kill you in the bargain.
I know it. But I got to keep the bones. Then you better get help, Bill.
He found the famous gunfighter Wyatt Earp in the Melodeon Saloon playing blackjack. Johnson drew him aside.
Mr. Earp, could I hire your services for the night?
Well, I imagine so, Earp said. In what capacity?
As a guard, Johnson said, and explained about his fossil bones, the room, and the Curry brothers.
That's fine, Earp said when he had heard it all. I will want $5.
Johnson agreed.
In advance.
Johnson paid him, right there in the saloon.
But I can count on you?
You surely can, Wyatt Earp said. I will meet you in your room at 10 o'clock tonight. Bring ammunition and plenty of whiskey. And don't worry any further. You have Wyatt Earp on your side now. Your problems are over.
He had dinner with Emily in the hotel dining room.
I wish you would give this up, she said.
They were exactly his sentiments. But he said, I can't, Emily. She kissed him lightly on the cheek.
Then good luck, Bill. I hope I see you tomorrow.
Rest assured, he said, and smiled bravely for her. She went up to her room. He went to his room and locked himself in. It was 9 o'clock in the evening.
10 o'clock passed, and 10:30. He shook his pocket watch, wondering if it was running right. Finally, he unlocked the room and went down into the hotel lobby. A pimply boy was behind the desk as night clerk.
Howdy, Mr. Johnson.
Howdy, Edwin.
You seen Mr. Earp?
Not tonight, I haven't.
But I know of his whereabouts.
What do you know?
He's at the Melodeon playing blackjack.
He was at the Melodeon this afternoon.
Well, he's still there.
Johnson looked at the wall clock. It, too, said 10:30.
He was supposed to meet me here.
Probably forgot, Edwin said.
We had an arrangement.
Probably drinking, Edwin said.
Can you go over there and get him for me?
I wish I could, but I have to stay here.
Don't worry, Mr. Earp is a responsible sort. If he says he'll come, I'm sure he'll be along shortly.
Johnson nodded and locked himself back in his room and waited. If they come in the door, he thought, I'd better be ready.
He put a loaded pistol into each of his boots at the foot of the bed. The hours dragged by. At midnight, he went out again in his wool socks to ask about Earp, but Edwin was asleep, and Earp's key was on the wall behind him, which meant he had not yet returned from the saloon. Johnson went back to his room and waited. All around him, the hotel was silent. He stared at the hands of his watch. He listened to it tick, and he waited. At 2, there was a scratching on the wall. He jumped up, raising his gun. He heard the scratching again.
Who's there?
There was no reply. More scratching.
Get away, he said,
his voice quavering. He heard a low squeaking, and the scratching moved quickly off.
He recognized the sound now.
Rats.
He slumped back down, tense and exhausted. He was sweating. His hands were shaking. This was not his line of business. He didn't have the nerve for it. Where was Wyatt Earp anyway?
I can't figure what you're so hot about, Earp said the next day,
We had a deal, Johnson said. That's what I'm so hot about.
He had not slept at all the night before. He was angry and tired.
Yes, we did, Earp said, to protect your fossils from the Curry boys.
And I paid you in advance.
Yes, you did.
And where were you?
Doing what I was hired to do, Earp said. I played blackjack all night. With the Curry boys.
Johnson sighed.
He was too tired to argue.
Well, what do you expect me to do? Earp said. Leave him to come and sit in the dark with you?
It's just that I didn't know.
You look peaked, Earp said sympathetically. You go get sleep.
Johnson nodded, started back to the hotel.
You want to hire me again tonight? Earp called to him.
Yes, Johnson said.
That'll be $5, Earp said.
I'm not paying you $5 to play blackjack, Johnson said.
Earp shrugged. Suit yourself, boy.
That night he put the loaded pistols and extra bullets in his boots again. He must have fallen asleep after midnight, because he awoke to the sound of wood splintering. The broken door opened and a figure slid into the room. The door closed again. It was pitch dark because of the crates blocking the window.
Foggy,
a voice whispered.
Wyatt,
Johnson whispered. The sharp click of a gun being cocked. A footstep. Silence. Breathing in the dark. Johnson realized he made an easy target and eased out of the bed and beneath it. He took one of the pistols out of its boot and flung the boot against the wall. At the sound of the boot hitting the wall, there was a tongue of flame as the man fired at the noise. Someone yelled immediately elsewhere in the hotel.
You get out, whoever you are, Johnson said.
The room filled with smoke now.
I have a loaded gun. You get on out.
Silence. Another footstep. Breathing.
That you, Foggy boy?
The door opened again, and another man came in.
He's in his bed, came a voice. Foggy, we're going to light a lamp now. Just sit still, and we will get this all straightened out.
Instead, the men opened fire into his bed, splintering the frame. Johnson grabbed his second pistol and lifted both guns, emptying each without skill. He heard wood splintering, groaning, something falling, then maybe the door being opened. He paused to reload, fumbling in the darkness. He heard breathing.
He was sure of it.
That made him nervous. He could imagine the killer squatting there, listening to Johnson's panicked exhalations, listening to the clink of the bullets going into the chambers, focusing on the sound, locating Johnson. He finished reloading. Still nothing.
Oh, Carmella,
came a sad and tired voice.
I know I've been...
The man's breathing became labored.
If I can just get my breath good.
He coughed, and there was a kick against the floor. Then a crackling, choking noise. Then nothing. In his journal, Johnson wrote, I apprehended then that I had killed the man. But the room was too dark to see who it was. I waited there on the floor with my guns ready in case the other shootist came back, and I resolved to fire first and ask questions afterward. But then I heard Mr. Perkins, the proprietor, calling from the hallway. I answered back. I told him I wasn't going to shoot, and then he appeared in the doorway with a lamp, throwing light across the room and down to the floor, where a big man lay dead, his blood a wet rug beneath him. There were three neat bullet wounds in the man's broad back. Perkins rolled the body over. In the guttering light of the lamp, he looked into the sightless eyes of Clem Curry.
Dead as a doornail,
he muttered. The hallway filled with voices, and then heads poked their way through the doorway to gawk.
Stand back, folks, stand back!
Judge Harlan pushed roughly through the onlookers into the room. Harlan was in ill humor,
Probably, Johnson thought, because he had been called out of bed. It turned out to be nothing of the sort. I left a hell of a poker game, the judge said, to deal with this here murder. He stared at the body. That's Clem Curry, isn't it? Johnson said it was. No loss to the community as far as I'm concerned, the judge said. What was he doing here?
Robbing me, Johnson said.
Figures, Judge Harlan said. He took a drink from a hip flask, passed it to Johnson. Who shot him? Johnson said he had. Well, the judge said, as far as it matters to me, that's fine. The only trouble is, you shot him in the back. Johnson explained that it was dark, and he could not see. I am sure of it, the judge said. But the problem is, you shot him 3 times in the back. Johnson said he hadn't intended to kill anyone at all. I am sure of it. You have no problem with me, but you may have some difficulty when Black Dick hears of it, tomorrow or the next day, depending if he's in town. This had already occurred to Johnson, and he did not like to think about it too long. You planning to leave Deadwood? The judge said. Not just yet, Johnson said. Judge Harlan took another pull from the flask. I would, he said. Myself. I'd be gone before daybreak.
Well, damn me, Sam Perkins said, fingering the bullet holes in the wall after the crowd had left. You surely had some hot work here, Mr. Johnson.
They didn't get the bones.
That's so.
But they got every one of my guests out of bed in the middle of the night, Mr. Johnson.
I'm sorry about that.
Scared Edwin the night clerk so bad he wet his trousers. I'm not fooling.
I'm sorry.
I can't run a hotel this way, Mr. Johnson. The Grand Central has its reputation. I want these bones out of here today, Perkins said.
Mr. Perkins, today, Perkins said, and that's final. And I'll charge you to repair the bullet holes. That'll be on your bill.
Where am I going to move them to? Ain't my problem.
Mr. Perkins, these bones are valuable to science.
We're a long way from science.
Just get them out of here.
Moving the bones. With the crates loaded in his wagon the next morning, he went first to the Deadwood Bank, but they had no space to store anything but gold dust. Then he tried Sutter's dry goods. Mr. Sutter had a strong room in the back where he stored his firearms for sale. Mr. Sutter refused outright, but Johnson took the opportunity to buy more bullets for his guns. The National Hotel was not as particular as the Grand Central, and was known to be accommodating. But the man at the desk said he had no storage facilities. Fielder's Saloon and Gaming House was open around the clock, and the scene of so many altercations that Fielder kept an armed guard to maintain order. He had a back room that was large enough. Fielder said no.
It's just bones, Mr. Fielder.
Maybe so, maybe not. Whatever it is, the Curry boys are after him. I want no part of it. Colonel Ramsey was feisty and had plenty of room in his stables. He just shook his head when Johnson asked him.
Is everybody afraid of the Curry brothers?
Everybody with sense, Ramsey said. The afternoon was drawing to an end, the light starting to fail, and the temperature in town was dropping quickly. Johnson went back to his photo studio, the Black Hills Art Gallery, but he had no customers. It seemed he had become extremely unpopular overnight. He was looking around the studio, trying to see whether he could store the bones there, when his landlord, Kim Singh, came in from the laundry with his young son, the one who had dragged away the dead body out of the street. Singh nodded and smiled, but as usual said nothing. The son said, "You need place to store some things?" The boy's English was pretty good.
"Yes, I do. What's your name?"
Kang.
I like your boots there, Kang.
The boy smiled.
Chinese boys never wore leather boots. His father said something to him.